Our guest today is Christopher McFarland. He's an assistant professor in genetics and genome science at Case Western Reserve University. His lab integrates evolutionary theory with quantitative experimentation to better understand tumor biology. Hi, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I wanted to start by asking, what's the relevance of evolution to understanding cancer?
Thanks for having me onto the podcast. So most people, I get asked this question a lot, and most people don't think of cancer as an evolutionary process, but all the ingredients for evolution are in evolving tumors. So individual cells within our body can mutate. And this happens in a tumor microenvironment, a local environment within our body that actually selects for the cancer phenotype. The cancer phenotype is increased cellular growth and avoidance of death. And this is advantageous to somatic cells within our body. So because all the ingredients of evolution are there, we can apply evolutionary theories to understand how tumors progress and actually adapt to the therapies that we use to try to remove them. And so we have really a whole over a century of quantitative theory that describes evolutionary dynamics, and our group and a lot of others are trying to take these theories into cancer biology so that we can predict cancer response and drug progression.
Right. So evolutionary processes like cancer are driven by selection pressure. How exactly do these forces come into play in cancer development?
Yeah, so natural selection really just selects for phenotypes that increase the prevalence of something in a population or a local environment. That's all it is. It's kind of an unavoidable thing. You can use the law of natural selection to understand natural populations. It's used in, a lot of sociological phenomena and business. And so cancer is really just cells that are producing more of themselves than designed to by our bodies. We even see evolution select for what we call selfish genes, which are these smaller components of our larger genome that will just kind of replicate themselves for no good reason to the genome. But they do so simply because natural selection selects for whatever increases its prevalence.
So as you mentioned, there's different phenotypes that are advantageous to cancer. Aside from proliferation, there's also things like genome instability. Does this lead exclusively to the progression of cancer?
No. So genome instability is this situation where cells or any individual starts replicating its genome less effectively, and then that increases the mutation rate. When that happens, you can accelerate evolutionary processes because you create more genetic variation in the population. And so there's in cancer a lot of previous theory to show that genome instability can accelerate the rate at which cells in our body evolve into cancer.
Right. By increasing genome instability, it's more likely to get mutations in genes that will allow the cancer to progress. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. And we call these mutations that progress cells towards cancer driver mutations because they drive the cancer phenotype.
Right. Okay, what if this genome instability leads to mutations in, like deleterious mutations in functional regions? Does natural selection select against this?
So this is what got me engaged in evolutionary theory, is that we know in microbial populations that the vast majority of mutations that arise are actually harmful to cells. Cells are these highly optimized machines, so you don't want to go around tinkering with them for the most part. So anytime you see genome instability, in natural populations, it tends to disappear quickly because it introduces all these deleterious variants. And we were interested in how this phenomenon might manifest in cancer.
Right. So do cancers carry deleterious mutations with them, or do they work more similarly to microbial populations where they're able to get the mutations in the driver genes and minimize deleterious ones?
Well, yeah, when we first got involved in this question, a lot of people in the field kind of argued that whatever cancers carry with them can't be deleterious, because if it was, then cancers wouldn't have these mutations. So even though we see kind of mutations scattered across cancer genomes, people were arguing that any mutation that wasn't causing cancer was effectively neutral. And then through a variety of techniques, including evolutionary modeling and experiments on cancer cell lines, we showed that a lot of these remaining mutations, which are the majority of mutations in cancer, are in fact deleterious, just like they would be in other natural populations.
Right. Okay. Well, using a model, how do you show that more mutations are deleterious than not?
Yeah, so the when we program these models, we sort of ordain certain effects of the mutations. They can be beneficial to cells within our body or deleterious. So you sort of presuppose that they're deleterious, and we were addressing this initial postulate of the field that a cancer population wouldn't accumulate deleterious mutations if they arose. And we showed that, given the mutation rates that we see in cancer and the genome instability that we see, and important, especially the different tumor sizes that cancers progress through, cancers have to start from one cell and grow to billions, that really isn't true. That if you allow deleterious mutations to arise in the population, at almost every reasonable cost to cells, these mutations are still going to accumulate during the tumor's evolutionary history. So the evolutionary modeling just tells us what's possible and not possible. And we showed that it's not really possible, given what we know about tumor evolution, for deleterious mutations to not accumulate.
Right. Okay. And how do you show that experimentally?
Yeah. So the simplest way is to just put random mutations into cancer cell lines. So these cells that we take out of patients and can propagate in the petri dish, and just measure how they affect cellular growth. And we find that random mutations on average reduce the growth rate of a cell by about 1%, which is in line with what we see in other, with the fitness cost of random mutations in a lot of other evolving populations, if not a little bit more deleterious. And that is a cost that's very consistent with deleterious mutations being able to accumulate in the tumor and having a profound effect on cancer progression.
Right. Okay. And is this the same for like cancers in all different types of tissues? Because I know that there are some cancers like melanomas that have like a higher mutational burden than other cancers. So do they work a little differently, or is it the same fundamental principles just to a different degree?
Yeah, that's one of the things that makes cancer such a difficult disease to understand, that you touched on it already. Melanomas have a very high mutation rate. Every cancer that descends from tissues exposed to the environment, so skin or lung or gastrointestinal tract, they all have very high mutation rates because of these environmental carcinogens. And so the cost of these deleterious mutations is much higher in these kind of cancer types than other cancer types. So a lot of blood cancers, and we have these soft tissue cancers, which have a much lower mutation rate. So the total mutational burden is a lot less in these other tumor types. But I also, you can never overstate how much heterogeneity there is in the disease. There's variation in the mutation rate between tumor types, but even two different melanomas, they can vary in their mutation rate 100-fold. So we have to be very careful when we to create models of this process, we're trying to model a lot of different evolutionary processes all at the same time. And if you try to think about it as something that happens a very specific way, you're going to come up with false conclusions.
Right. Well, why are cancers able to accumulate these deleterious mutations, and why is this not seen in the other evolutionary processes that you mentioned?
Yeah, that's a great question. As I had alluded to earlier, it is seen, this accumulation of deleterious mutations is seen in microbes that have elevated mutation rates. But the reason why it's not observed in a lot of organisms is because of genetic recombination. Cancers are a little bit different than normal human reproduction in that cells within our body reproduce through mitosis, whereas humans reproduce through sexual reproduction and meiosis. And genetic recombination is a really important tool for getting rid of harmful variation in the population, because it allows certain combinations. It allows us to kind of separate healthy parts of our genome from damaged parts of our genome.
So it's the difference in sexual evolution compared to asexual evolution that impacts whether deleterious mutations are able to accumulate?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay. So given that most cancers are able to accumulate all these deleterious passengers, how can they still function if they have all of these bad mutations?
Well, we argued that it really is just kind of a race. Cancers are rapidly acquiring advantageous mutations that increase the rate of proliferation, and then these harmful deleterious patients, which reduce the evolutionary fitness of cells. So these two processes are kind of stochastic, and the one can win out over the other. And cancer is actually a pretty rare outcome for an early stage tumor. So when cancer does arise, it happens because the drive for the advantageous mutations were accumulated at an inordinate rate.
Right. Does the order of driver mutations matter for cancer progression? So, for example, is it critical to get like genome instability when the tumor is very small so that it can grow to a larger size, and then less important to get genome instability if a tumor is already large?
Yeah. So, again, I just talked about heterogeneity, and our lab is, you're touching on a very interesting question. Our lab is very interested in the different paths that normal tissue can take to cancer. And there isn't one path. Again, it's dangerous to think that there's a certain order of events that is necessary to get cancer. But there was some theoretical evolutionary work that predates us that showed that you're much more likely to get cancer if genome instability happens early. And that's because in the right amounts, genome instability can potentiate the accumulation of drivers. And so it sets up the tumor for rapid evolution towards cancer. So people have argued that it's generally an early event, but anything can and does happen in the order of events that accumulate on the progression to cancer.
Right. Okay. So like you mentioned that it's this race between the drivers and the deleterious passengers. How is like the fate of the race determined? What kind of tips it in favor of the driver or the passenger?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. That's something we spent some time with. Yeah, so we find, as I was sort of mentioning, that accumulation of deleterious mutations is a symptom of early tumor progression because early tumors are small in population size. So once the population size of a tumor gets larger, the forces of natural selection get more efficient. They get better at selecting for advantageous variation and removing deleterious variation. So this kind of creates a runaway train effect where if a if a tumor population happens to accumulate a few drivers very early on, it'll grow to a healthy intermediate size that really favors the accumulation of further drivers, and the tumor can population size can really take off and grow super exponentially, which is something other modelers have seen. But then conversely, in our model, if the opposite happens, if drivers aren't accumulated particularly fast early on, then this deleterious mutational load will accrue, drive down the population size, and make it even harder for natural selection to purge these deleterious mutations from the population. So that creates this death spiral where that is sometimes called mutational meltdown, where just more and more passengers accumulate and prevent the tumor from ever progressing.
Right. Okay. Is this in line with previous ideas in cancer biology, like multi-hit models that are used to explain the late incidence of cancer?
Yeah, so the Amritraj-Dhal multi-hit model argues that there's just a small number, you know, from cancer incidence data people had initially estimated on the order of 5 to 6, small number of these driver events that are needed for gradual progression of the cancer. We don't argue against any of that. We still, in our models, require a small or moderate or medium-sized set of drivers for progression. We're just sort of amending this model to say that, hey, all these other mutations are having an important effect too and can prevent progression.
Okay. And what about loss of heterozygosity and Knudsen's two-hit hypothesis? For those who don't know, this is the idea that tumor suppressor genes require both alleles to be inactivated to lead to cancer progression, since tumor suppressor genes are usually recessive. And it was supported by clinical data showing earlier incidence of familial retinoblastoma compared to sporadic. Does this agree with your models or not?
Yeah, great question. And I think that's, thanks for bringing this up, because that's, I think, a great example of how theoretical models kind of progress over time. So Sanusen's two-hit model is a specific incarnation of this Amritraj-Dhal multi-stage model. And like you're saying, it shows how clinical genetics has progressed over time. And back in Knudsen's day, the 1970s, 1980s, people were looking at a lot of germline predispositions for cancer. And as you mentioned, these people with a germline predisposition for retinal cancers had this very different incidence rate in which tumors arose. And Knudsen really showed how those genetics that they were seeing in patients is very consistent with this earlier multi-stage model of progression. So it's a specific incarnation. It says not just that there are multiple hits, but there are specifically two, and they happen in this specific gene, like you said. And so that makes bolder predictions about the genetics of the disease and what happens with patients who start off with certain genetic mutations. And it's a good example of how models can be more specific or vague, and that there's a fundamental trade-off there. Knudsen's model is more predictive in the case of retinal cancers, but it doesn't explain, say, colorectal cancer. Whereas this multi-stage model, because it's vague about the number of drivers, and it's even vague about what is a driver. In the multi-stage model, we could have mutations in protein-coding genes. We could have epigenetic changes in cancers that are rate-limiting for progression. We could have mutations outside of the protein-coding genome. Those different driver events could all be consistent with this multi-stage model. And so because of its vagaries, this other model is actually able to explain tumor progression more generally. It just doesn't make as strong predictions.
Right. Okay. And in the cancer field in general, are these models usually complemented well with experimental work to validate them, or with like genome data?
you're asking a good question there. I would say no. There's one thing that I was very frustrated with as a grad student is how fragmented our community is. There's theoreticians and computationalists who come with more mathematical backgrounds, and they have their own language, and they're often talking past the experimentalists who have a lot more training in molecular biology, and they have their own language. And both sides, I think, have trouble understanding the concerns of sort of the other camp. Cancer biology is just a massive field, and so it's easy to sort of break up into these cliques. And so I think our field has a unique problem in that there's a lot of experimental work that doesn't get positioned well into the theoretical literature, and then a lot of theoretical work that doesn't get tested. So something our group is really trying to do is translate these two approaches. I think that's really one of the key missing ingredients in our field right now.
Right. What is your approach to bridging these two camps?
Yeah, so it's really, there's no trick to it. I happened to be in a theoretical lab as a graduate student, and then I worked very closely with experimentalists when I became a postdoc. So I would encourage other people to do that. And I think all I can really say there is you have to be patient, and you have to, I think, be willing to give up the reins a little bit. I think both sides really want to dictate exactly what a project's going to be about, and good projects are smart for multiple reasons. So if you can find someone, if you're an experimentalist and you find a theorist who's interested in working with you, you should pay attention to what they are interested in, even if you find it silly, and vice versa. If you're a theorist and you find an experimentalist, you should take a little bit more time to really try to understand not just what it is that your partners are trying to study, but why they think it's more important than your special model.
Right. So in your lab, how do you experimentally study tumor evolution?
Yeah, so it's really a progression of postdoctoral work that I was lucky to partake in. So I joined the lab of Monty Winslow at Stanford, and we were, it was an exciting time because CRISPR technologies were just starting to become widely used in biology. And we wanted to use animal models of cancer progression. So there's, again, a longstanding history of using genetically engineered mice to model tumor progression from the start. So these mouse models that Monty was working on were very exciting to me because they could study early tumor evolution. And I really thought that the clinical data we were getting kind of misses out on these early stages. And then we were hoping to use CRISPR technologies to model all these different genetic paths that tumors can take in a comprehensive way. We wanted to introduce mutations into tumors in these mouse models in a systematic way, rather than just kind of picking someone's favorite gene, which is really what the field was doing for generations. So I was just really excited about the sort of systems level way in which the Winslow Lab wanted to approach this problem and the stage of tumor progression that they were studying. And so we developed this new approach, which we called tumor barcoding sequencing, or TUBA-seq, because it allowed us to introduce a wide variety of mutations to early stage lung cancers. And then the other key innovation was we used random DNA barcodes, so just combinations, random combinations of DNA, to track the lineage of the cells that descend from every mouse lung epithelial cell that we conferred mutations to. And so these barcodes really made these mouse models quantitative, which again was really, I think, a key innovation for the kind of work I want to do, where I'm testing these quantitative evolutionary models. And so we were able to get very precise quantitative measurements of natural selection's effect on mutations, the fitness effects that various mutations conferred to cancer. And so we're continuing to use that technology in our own lab. And a lot of our collaborators are very excited about it, not just because it allows us to sort of map out all the paths that cancer takes, but also because it gives us very precise readouts of how certain tumor genotypes respond to various therapeutics.
Right. And when you say introducing mutations in a systematic way, what exactly do you mean by that?
Yeah, so one of the really powerful things about CRISPR technologies is you have this programmable gene editing enzyme. It's called Cas9. And this Cas gene is fed a small RNA that tells it where to cut in the genome. Well, you know, so in these mouse experiments, we're studying thousands, sometimes even millions of cells within the mouse's lung. So in each cell, the RNA that we feed that Cas enzyme can be different. We can tell us one cell to cut one region of the genome based on the RNA we design. We can tell another cell to cut another commonly mutagenized gene in cancer. And just because of all the technologies that came out of this genomic revolution, we can actually synthesize dozens and even hundreds of thousands of different RNAs, all programming this enzyme to cut different parts all at once. So we sometimes call this procedure multiplex because it's we're really performing multiple genetic editing events all in one experiment.
Right. And how do you choose where to make these mutations?
Very carefully, because anyone you talk to is going to have strong opinions. So essentially, just we looked at the most mutated genes in human lung cancers. But then we know quite a bit about the pathways that these mutations arise within. And so we sometimes avoided genes that were either hard to edit or were redundant with other genes that we were already editing in the same pathway. And that actually ended up raising a few eyebrows. Our recommendation is...
Oh, why?
Well, not in a sinister way. I think cancer biology has a long history of people with their gene of interest kind of putting the thumb on the scale in terms of how they set up genetic screens. So for good reason, people wanted to make sure we were studying things in sort of an unbiased way.
Right. So the idea was to introduce mutations so that it kind of follows the path of the way that a tumor would normally develop. That's the idea?
Exactly. And these are really powerful models. We can give one tumor initiating mutation and wait about a year to get invasive disease and metastatic disease, advanced disease, or we can give two or three, and then we can find metastatic disease after, really just 2 or 3 months if we give the right combination of mutations. So this whole mouse model is very consistent with this multi-hit model of tumor progression, and very consistent with the idea that evolution, you can't really stop evolution. We see a lot of tumor evolution within these mice. And based on the number and combinations of drivers that we give, we can kind of look at different stages of the disease.
Right. And what about other types of cancer? Are you able to do that in a mouse model as well?
Yeah. So there's a couple ways that people create tumors in mice, sometimes people will use what are called lineage-specific Cre. So you can have this other gene editing enzyme Cre and have it only active in a certain cell type, and then depending on the cell type that you choose, you could model lung cancer or or liver cancer or what have you. What we actually do and others have done is deliver the virus to whatever organ of interest we have. So we started off doing this in lung because lung is just really the most genomically complex cancer and it's one of the main killers. And we also showed that we could do it in pancreatic cancer, although that's a harder surgery. And then others have used our model to, we can model, again, these soft tissue cancers. If we deliver the virus to the mouse's calf, others have used it to model bladder cancers and different types of lung cancers as well. It's really just where you choose to deliver the virus.
Okay. And what are the limitations of using a mouse model to model human cancer?
Yeah. So your question kind of almost answers itself. You're modeling mouse genetics in some sense, not human genetics. Mm-hmm. And mice don't have to live as long as humans. So they do seem to have fewer tumor suppressive functions embedded into their genomes. So, the biggest issue I would say is that you're not really exactly modeling human genetics.
Right. Is there any way to test this on human tissue, like organoids or things like that?
Yeah. So the other, exactly. So the other major class of models, so we have these animal models, which really do a great job of recapitulating the natural environment of tumors. And then we have these culture models, which are based, you can take cancers or even other cells out of humans, put them in a petri dish and with the right ingredients, propagate those cells for indefinitely. And so when you do that, so the simplest models just take one cell type and propagate it. And so that that can reproduce cell intrinsic phenotypes very well, but there's this, as I was sort of mentioning, there's this complex structure to real tumors. So people have developed, especially in recent years, techniques to kind of allow the cells that we pull out of the human body to start to form some of the microscopic tissue structure that we actually see within tumors, and those are called organoids because it's kind of really the smallest emergent structure within an organ, and so you can cold culture multiple cell types to help create these organoids, and just use other techniques to model a little bit more faithfully the tissue structure of real tumors.
Right. Okay. So what would you say are the remaining limitations on experimentally studying tumor evolution?
That's a long list. As I mentioned, so just obviously you can't do experiments on humans. So we're never, because that's unethical. So we're never really going to study the real McCoy. What we're doing is using different kinds of models to study different facets. And I think, as I mentioned, if you just study one animal, you may miss stuff that is specific to human genetics. Especially in the animal modeling community, I was frustrated by the lack of precision and the inability to use these models to really test quantitative theory. So I think there's a big push right now to kind of make all of these models of cancer more quantitative. And again, if you use culture models, one thing I didn't mention is that they only recapitulate the properties of the tumor microenvironment that you know of. And even doing that can be difficult at times. And so we know that there's very complex interactions between the tumor and its environment. And so that's difficult to model and particularly difficult to discover kind of novel biology. Another limitation of these animal models is that most readouts cause you to sacrifice, to euthanize the animal. And so you can't track dynamics over time, which is really critical for an evolutionary understanding. We want to see how one event leads to other events, and we can't really do that. And just more generally, everything you model is in some sense something you already know about. So it's very hard. We have a very poor understanding of the epigenetic changes that cancer goes through, and it's hard to model that when you don't know what to program into your animal or culture model. And like I said, the same problem arises with our understanding of the microenvironment of the tumor.
Right. Okay. So would you say that more foundational science to do with epigenetics and the microenvironment would help to make experimental study better?
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself. We're not going to cure cancer in the next decade. And there's big blind spots in our thinking about this. And so we need more effective foundational models.
Right. Okay. And I wanted to discuss your work in the context of directions for cancer therapeutics and treatment. So do your models and do your studies provide an explanation for why some cancer treatments work and others don't?
Yeah, so that's a big question in general in the field. And touching back on this deleterious passenger model that we discussed, one thing that I think was particularly noteworthy about this model is it was able to explain this paradoxical relationship in the clinic where some of the most genomically unstable tumors the clinicians were seeing actually respond to therapy better than tumors with an intermediate mutation rate or intermediate levels of genome instability. In our model, that makes perfect sense. That's because a moderate level of genome instability is in the sweet spot where you're getting rapid creation of driver mutations, which could evolve resistance to the therapy, but then also not accumulating so many mutations that you're overwhelmed by this mutational load. And then if you had a very high mutation rate, you would experience interference effects between these mutations and have trouble adapting because of all the deleterious mutations. But in sort of existing models of resistance, you get this result that just increased genome instability just always leads to more effective adaptation to treatment, which wasn't what the clinicians were observing. So it's a great example of the utility of our model.
Right. Okay. And what about the development of drug resistance in cancers?
Yeah. So that's a very active field of research. And again, we're engaged in a number of studies to try to understand it, as are many other groups. And I'll just say, like cancer progression, it's another thing where these multiplexed genomically comprehensive techniques are really important, because we're finding that there also are a lot of paths to drug resistance that sometimes researchers miss if they have one favorite gene.
Right. And would you say that your work kind of suggests that certain therapeutics should be explored more than others?
Yeah. So something I hadn't mentioned was that when people were studying genome instability in microbes and really all evolving natural populations, they found that the main reason why mutations are deleterious is that they actually cause, at least within protein-coded regions, they cause the proteins in our body to just kind of assemble incorrectly. We call this protein misfolding. They just kind of cause improper assembly, and all those broken machines kind of just accumulate like junk in the endoplasmic reticulum of our cells. And so that junk kind of weighs down the cells. And in microbes, it's known that microbes can activate these what are called chaperone proteins, proteins that clean up the junk. And that'll help buffer against these deleterious mutations that arise in genomically unstable microbes. So we looked for that same phenomenon in human cancers and observed it, that basically as the mutational load in a cancer increases, cells progressively increase their chaperone, the production of the chaperone proteins more and more. And we've recently shown that if you knock out these chaperone proteins, that exacerbates the mutational load even further. And that's a really cool finding for me, because we already have drugs that are approved for use in cancer that target these chaperone proteins. And so we're really trying to pursue methods to better use these existing drugs.
Right. And would this be more specific to cancers than other existing treatments like chemotherapy, which have really bad side effects because they just target all proliferating cells?
Yeah. So we have these next generation of what some people call molecularly targeted chemotherapies, which often have less side effects. Actually, some of these some of the first therapies that targeted chaperone protein still have stronger side effects than you'd really want. So these drugs go through several generations of improvement, often with a goal of reducing their side effects. But yeah, I think the more we can use these molecular targeted therapies, the better it is for patients. There's a lot of drugs that are very specific to tumors nowadays and don't have the side effects that most people are familiar with chemotherapy.
Okay. Is personalized medicine important here then, to identify like exactly what's happened to lead to tumor formation?
Yeah, that's a popular goal right now, and evolutionary theory helps us understand why we need personalized medicines. Every tumor evolves its own somewhat unique set of mutations, and we've shown that it's not just a small number of driver mutations that are important, but also all these passengers. So you're never going to see two perfectly identical tumors. So we have to develop rational approaches to dealing with every patient's unique tumor. And I think sort of evolutionary forecasts can be really helpful in that effort.
Right. Right. And what's the challenge in getting personalized medicine to be applied even more in the clinic?
Yeah, well, you need smart therapeutics, you need precise mm-hmm. therapeutics, which we're still working on, and you need to have multiple weapons in your arsenal, which we're still working on. But I think and then you also need very good reconnaissance. You need to be able to measure exactly what's going on in the tumor. And really now in hospitals right now, pathology departments are going through a revolution dealing with all the data that we're now capable of collecting in patients and trying to put it together. But from my perspective, the biggest challenge there is making sense of all this data and coming up with those rational prescriptions given unique set of circumstances. I often kind of liken cancer biology to a farmer's almanac in the way clinical trials and medical doctors think about it. They just kind of, you know, they decide when to plant their corn or give their crops based on these broad categories of recurrent statistical phenomenon. And in our lab and a lot of others are trying to create these forecasts, much like weather forecasts, where we don't just look at very broad trends across these kind of arbitrary clines or groups of patients and really try to have dynamical equations that make predictions for every specific circumstance.
Right. And so do you think personalized medicine is the most promising avenue to quote unquote curing cancer, or what about other things like immunotherapy?
Well, yeah. And this isn't an either or question. Mm-hmm. I would say, so immunotherapy, we're actually collaborating with, or we're in talks with working with a company that's trying to come up with personalized immunotherapies. You may have read recently about these CAR T therapies that are very specific to each patient. So I think immunotherapy is one of those arrows in the quiver of a very precise medicine that you can use as part of your personalized therapy arsenal.
Right. And how does your work fit into immunotherapy, actually? Because I know that if there's like a higher mutational burden, it's easier to treat because there's more tumor antigens.
Yeah, I wish you could tell me that question too, because immunotherapy really is the most promising therapy this century. So we're engaged in that, and you touched on a very important observation that people have made, which is that more mutations tends to help therapeutic response. But actually, one of the counterintuitive things that we're finding is that even though that's predictive for specific tumor types, so immunotherapy works very well, for example, in melanomas, which, as you mentioned, have a very high mutational burden, it doesn't explain therapeutic responses within melanomas. So, for example, a melanoma with fewer mutations doesn't respond better to chemo or to immunotherapy than a cell that has more mutations. And that's counterintuitive, I think, to us and to a lot of researchers, because our understanding is that the immune system is just kind of picking up on any sort of change between the cancer's genome and your original genome, any sort of change that it can detect. So more ought to be better within patients. And so we're very actively engaged in understanding why that is. I don't really want to shortchange our research there, but we think what's really important is thinking specifically about the most immunogenic passenger in a cancer and not just the aggregate load, because it seems like the immune system really has to latch on to something, some very specific change.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I guess that makes sense, because like I remember reading in your papers this idea that no individual passenger has a large effect, but it's a collective effect of many passengers, which makes sense to me in part, but also not really, because I thought surely some passengers have a much bigger effect if they're in like a very very important pathway.
That's a great thought, and I want to say there have been other researchers that showed exactly that. So I try to distinguish between what we call mildly deleterious mutations, and then there's also what are called lethal mutations or severely deleterious mutations, which can be nearly lethal. And other researchers have shown that really when you, any mutation that completely destroys the last remaining function, the last remaining allele of a central gene, those mutations are effectively purged by cancers at any mutation rate. So severely deleterious mutations won't accumulate in the population. It's these kind of mildly deleterious mutations, which, like I said, they don't completely destroy function of the gene. They just cause it to assemble improperly a certain fraction of the time.
Right. And okay, so we kind of touched on this a little before, but just to bring all the thoughts together and to summarize, what do you think the big changes are that need to happen in the cancer biology field for more progress and like a quote unquote cure to be found?
Yeah, there are a lot of challenges. I think two of the ones that we talked about a little bit, there's been a lot of progress in immunotherapy, and I think we still very much don't understand exactly how the immune microenvironment interacts with the tumor, and that's a major blind spot for us right now. As I alluded to at other points too, we don't understand chromatin, what goes on in the nucleus, period. And for that reason, we don't understand a lot of the mechanism by which this epigenetic change happens in cancers. And I think that's another big blind spot. Molecular biology and immunology aren't the fastest growing departments here at Case. The fastest growing department here is the graduate program is the systems biology program. And I think the systems biology problem is a little bit hard to define, because it's not one problem. And I guess in cancer, I can just give you a quick story of how we're using our sort of genomically comprehensive mouse model to understand therapeutic response to existing drugs. So one thing we observe is, we can give our mice this drug that targets this CDK pathway. And so this is one of those molecularly targeted chemotherapies that has minimal side effects. And the genetics of how tumors respond makes sense within the pathway. So if we have tumors with mutations upstream of the targeted gene, they're particularly sensitive to the therapy, as a molecular biologist would expect. Mutations downstream of the gene are particularly resistant, but that's just the tip of the iceberg of what we're seeing. We actually see that mutations in every other cancer-causing pathway also have some sort of interaction with the drug that's not targeting their pathway. And this isn't a problem of off-target effects. It's a problem that we see in every single drug that we give the mice. And so I think the simplest explanation for that is just that really every pathway in cancer interacts with every other pathway. And this everything interacting with everything is a problem at every scale in biology. We struggle to understand immunology because there's just so many different cell types, and we can understand what they all do in isolation, but we struggle to understand how they operate as an orchestra. And I just told you a story about mutations where natural selection is very simple when acting on individual mutations, but if it acts on multiple mutations in the genome at once, we get these complicated interference effects. And so I really think making sense of these interactomes at every scale in biology is the biggest foundational problem in cancer and probably every other disease field today.
Right. And how do you go about understanding the interactome and how these pathways cross-link?
I don't know. The solution has been lots of math and mm-hmm. and fancy computers. And we have these techniques, ancient techniques in linear algebra to deal with high dimensional problems. And there's a lot of active research there, but it's not really making sense of it for most of the problems we're trying to solve. And so I think if we can do a better job of even just defining the problem better, and developing a better toolkit for that, that's going to revolutionize biology.
Right. Do you think that it's this foundational understanding of biology that's the most, the biggest hurdle to curing cancer? And what about other hurdles like collaboration between academia and pharmaceutical companies?
Yeah, so at a foundational level, and universities are really great for foundational research. I think sometimes the general public misunderstands where universities are good and pharma's good. Pharma's very good at taking projects across the finish line because there's strong financial incentives to do so. But sort of as Isaac Newton said, if I see further, it's because I stood on the shoulder of giants. And a foundation is what allows people to stand tall and see farther. And that has to be open science for people like Isaac Newton to take advantage of anything that's done foundationally. And there's not a financial incentive for pharmaceutical companies to share what they learn. So publicly funded research is uniquely equipped to address fundamental questions in a scientific field. And I also think a university is just they're young. Their real job is to train the next generation. And we also know at a sociological level that young researchers are a lot better at questioning the foundations of a field than people like me. So universities are great in that regard. But like I said, the within academic subdisciplines, there's a lot of fragmentation and there's fragmentation between industry and academia. I think labor markets are getting a little bit more mobile and more people are crossing the aisle. There's more and more graduate students doing internships in pharmaceutical companies. There's pharmaceutical companies establishing fellowships with universities, and that's great. There's more and more professors with experience on both sides. So I think things are improving, but as I mentioned, I worry a lot about what this means for open science. And I also worry about what it means in terms of conflicts of interest when we're trying to create these very valuable pharmaceutical tools. So I really think y'all should consider having someone from the industry side on your podcast.
Yeah, definitely. I think that would be really interesting. I also wanted to ask, how did you get into this combination of quantitative and qualitative work? Was it an active choice? Because I personally find it really difficult to develop the skills for both simultaneously.
I did too. And it wasn't an active choice. And it's hard because a lot of the seasoned professors that you're going to interact with, they didn't take your path. And so they're not going to even know how to properly advise you. So for me, I declared biology when I was a sophomore in college, and I was interested in physics. It's just cool to me that humanity has these theories that are precise to 12 decimal points. And I remember asking my biology advisor if any of these physics and math classes that I was taking, if they were useful for biology. And they said, no, biology is this qualitative field. Yeah. And you laugh, I laugh with my colleagues now about it, because if anything, those math and physics classes proved more useful for what I'm trying to do today than at any point because of this interacting problem. And so, you know, it wasn't easy studying two completely different disciplines. But I talk to MDs who say their degree in philosophy is more useful for how they think about patient problems than any pre-med course they took. I talk to people from, you know, I was just at a conference where people were talking about that there's this shortage of artists in science. So I think the only way I was able to be interdisciplinary was by just doing what I found interesting and not caring what my advisor said. So that's the only advice I can really give you. Just study what piques your interest and don't listen to me.
I guess piggybacking off of that, do you have any general advice for young scientists?
Yeah. Like I said, just do what you find interesting. I also will say, and be promiscuous in what you study. Every scientist that I admire has reinvented themselves 3 or 4 different times. And I'll also say, just try not to judge fields by their cover. I was when I first got involved in this field in cancer biology, there was a lot of specialists and a lot of it seemed like it was kind of only a problem for the rich world. And it wasn't until I kind of got in deep into this field that I started to realize, no, this is a really difficult fundamental question for us to understand, and there's a lot of room for creativity and different ways of thinking. And it's quickly becoming even though we're curing more and more cancers, cancer's killing more and more people around the globe, because the industrialized world is now being killed by cancer as much as any other disease. So I wasn't excited about this field when I first got into it. But then once I really started to understand the problem, I got a lot more interested in cancer biology.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, thank you.